Welcome to The Long Box of Darkness, a podcast looking at horror in comic book form. I'm your host, Herman Lowe. Join me as we take a peek inside The Long Box of Darkness. Well, listeners, it's that time again, and what I mean by that time is podcasting time. I haven't done it in 2 weeks, so I might be a little bit rusty. I might be on my game tonight, who knows? I've had a few drinks, not because I'm an alcoholic or anything, just to calm the nerves a little bit. Gives me a nice, even tone to my voice. Also, makes me say things that I sometimes regret, which I leave in, you know, so that you can get the raw, unedited version of my psyche. Hopefully, not too disturbing. At least, not compared to the subject matter we're normally talking about. Today we'll be looking at a very, very sentimental issue. A comic book that I've had since I was 6 years old. I didn't appreciate it back then. I only came to read and love it probably when I was about nine. Around 1985 or so, 1984. But I still have it. It's in a bit of a rough condition. I've since bought it in a collection, and it's called The House of Mystery, number 318, featuring I, Vampire. And it was printed in 1983. July of 1983, I should mention, and it features three stories. The first stories have, of course, the vampire character Andrew Bennett, created by J.M.D. Matisse, a famous comic book writer, and the title of this comic is usually I, Vampire. The story itself doesn't really have a title. The second story is a shorter one called The Day After Doomsday. And then the final story is called Stalk and Slash. So today we're going to be using the Bloody Mary rating system. And we'll see how it goes from there. Okay, let's get into the comic.
Good evening, fiends fans. And welcome to my crawly crypt. This little drama is about one of life's unexpected pleasures. Dying, that is. Most of us only get to do it once, and it's all over before you can really enjoy it. But one man did get to die again, and he liked it so much, he started doing it for a living.
House of Mystery number 317 had a story in it which featured the death of Andrew Bennett's friend Mishkin, a Russian vampire who was helping Andrew to track down his lover, Mary, the Queen of Blood, hence our Bloody Mary rating system. So Andrew's been hunting Mary, as he usually does, and he's mourning the loss of his friend when we get to issue 318, which we'll be discussing right now. To give you a bit of an overview of the character, Andrew Bennett is this typical 16th century aristocrat. He's a nobleman. He kind of appears, let's say for instance, if the character in the Dracula novel, Sir Arthur Holmwood, who is the fiancé of Lucy Westenra, if he had been turned into a vampire, this is what he would have been like. This is the type of vampire you would expect him to be. So Andrew's this kind of guy, and he's proficient at all kinds of aristocratic activities, such as sword fighting, probably hunting. He's very intelligent. He's a master of strategy. And he is typically also a vampire. His history basically involves him being turned into a vampire by his lover, Mary. And she became a vampire a short time before he did. And she quickly fell in love with the bloodlust and with the power, and she wanted to take over the world. She created her own cult, a vampiric cult. And Andrew was against this. He abhors the taking of innocent lives. He resisted his vampiric nature. And so he's been at loggerheads with Mary for the last 400 years, give or take a few decades. And he's been hunting her down. That's his story in The House of Mystery. And he's probably one of the, his story is probably one of the longest running stories in The House of Mystery title, which was published in DC from the late 1950s to the early 1980s. And this is just before the comic book was canceled, probably about 6 or 7 issues before. So you've got Andrew Bennett pursuing Mary, and that's where the story kicks off again. But first we've got on the first page the horror host of the House of Mystery, Kane. He looks like a kind of Wolverine with spectacles, and he's very thin, not at all heavily muscled like Logan. But he's got the same kind of pointed tufts of hair sticking out from his temples, and he's also got a very hairy face and a beard and side whiskers. But he wears glasses as well, and he's got this evil grin on his face most of the time with these very sharp, piercing eyes. And of course, this is the actual Cain from the Bible who's hosting the, and he's also the keeper of the House of Mystery. So he starts off by saying, "Greetings, devil disciples. Cain, your horrifying host here, speaking to you from the devastating depths of the Paris metro. What, you ask? This does not look like Gay Paris. Maybe to you, mes friends, but one of my stories takes place in the City of Love. And what good is a intro page if you're not introducing? So on that perilously pragmatic note, turn the page, if you dare." All right, so he mixes it with a bit of a French accent in there, since he's in the catacombs below Paris, because that's where the story is set. Please excuse my horrible French accent. I doubt there's any French listeners out there, but you never know. So what happens then? We've got this great second intro page, which shows Andrew in a type of portrait reminiscent of a ghostly version of Gustav Klimt, the artist who did these otherworldly golden-like portraits of females. But here you definitely see the demonic aspect to this piece of art. Andrew's being plagued by vampiric ghosts, all beautiful women. And then we've got the roll call of the creators. We've got writers Dan Mishkin and Gary Cohn, pencilers Dan Day and Tom Sutton. You've got Ben Oda on letters, and the colorist being Adrian Roy. Of course, the editor Karen Berger, and iVampire created by J.M.D. Matisse. So Andrew starts off by explaining his origin again, as most comics back in those days had a brief recap of the character's origin. And I'm going to read this because this is the first iVampire comic that I've ever discussed on the show. I'm probably going to discuss more because he's one of my favorite vampire characters in comic books. Andrew says in his brief monologue describing his origin, "I, the pursuer of demons, have been their prey as well. I, who made my love a thing of soulless evil, have hunted her and 400 years past our deaths, still hating her, but yearning for her still, while she has craved only for power and my final demise. We have chased each other in an endless round, she now the quarry, I now her game. She is Mary, queen of the blood-red moon, and I am her nemesis. I, Andrew Bennett. I, vampire." Great introduction. I love it. Gives me chills just reading it. I'm sitting here covered in goose pimples. All right, so we've got Andrew and his companion, whom I neglected to mention. He had two companions, Mishkin, the Russian who died in the previous issue. And then he's got a female companion, a very attractive young girl called Deborah. And Deborah is quite formidable in her own right. She can take care of herself, even though she's only human. She has killed dozens of vampires, along with Andrew and Mishkin, in their hunt for the Blood Red Moon. And she also lost some family members and loved ones to Mary, Queen of Blood. So she's got her own reason for pursuing Mary. And she's a very important character in the Andrew Bennett story. One of the main characters, definitely. Also one of the very few, I think, back then, strong females in comics. She's really one of the female comic book personas that stick out in my mind whenever I think about horror titles. This Deborah. All right, so Andrew's giving a quick recap of how they hunted Mary across the centuries and across Europe. And it seems that Andrew has acquired a type of experimental serum, which they acquired in the previous volumes. And this is the end game. They finally track Mary to her lair in Paris. They know that they're closing in on her. So Andrew has decided to give himself an advantage when battling Mary, because Mary's got an army called the Blood Red Moon, her cult warriors, all vampires facing them. So Andrew needs an edge. So what he does is he decides to ingest the serum, which is intended to make a vampire human, but with all the vampiric attributes still in place. However, all the weaknesses will disappear. So the weakness to sunlight, vulnerability to religious iconography, all of that will be in the past, and Andrew will be able to walk as a living vampire in daylight. And that will definitely allow him to take out Mary, because Mary and her Blood Red Moon has to sleep during the day, of course, so they can hunt for them and stake them where they rest their heads. So Andrew decides to take the packet, but Deborah warns him. She says it's never been tested. It might have fallen into your hands for a reason. It might be a trap. It might be poison. Mary might have planted it from the scientist you stole it from, or you acquired it from. But Andrew says there's no time to waste. And this is the first time I've seen Andrew Bennett this impulsive in the many comics I've read about him. He's normally a strategist who plans things, many moves ahead, chess player type of opponent, really, when it comes to him destroying his vampiric enemies. But this time he is does something very rash. He just ingests the serum and immediately is racked by incredible pain. And he clutches his stomach and screams, and Deborah can't do anything for him. It becomes so bad that she suggests that they take him to a hospital, but he laughs and scoffs at her. And then finally, after a whole, an endless night of pain, basically, of agony, Andrew starts crying, and he says, "The pain is gone, Deborah. I'm a man again." And then just as the sun rises, the dawn comes through the window, he stands up and Deborah says, "What are you doing? Are you insane?" He says, "Don't you see? I can face the sun." And he stands in the sun and basks in it. And he says, "For the first time in 400 years. And then immediately, to test his own vampiric powers, he shape changes into a bat and transforms back into a human again. And then suddenly he becomes what he calls ravenous. And he says, "I hunger." And suddenly Deborah freaks out and she says, "Dear God." And then Andrew surprised her by saying, no, you don't understand. I'm hungry for food, for real, actual human food." And then for the first time in 400 years, he eats a hearty breakfast. And then we've got this funny little scene at the bottom of page 5. The final panel where he says his appetites for food has returned, and other appetites as well. Very suggestive. And then he sort of hugs Deborah from behind and fondles her. And Deborah seems to be enjoying it. So this is the first time we ever get an intimation of Andrew having feelings for Deborah. So far, they've been companions and soldiers in this war, but they've never shown any affection for each other other than that. So after this bout of possible lovemaking, which is the first he's had in four centuries, he and Deborah take in the sights of Paris. So he's been to Paris many times before, but this is Deborah's first time, and they enjoy a typical couple on a date. And Andrew says he feels completely normal. He still has all his powers, except there's a slight stiffness in his joints. And we see him constantly massaging his hands. So he shrugs that off and just attributes it to becoming alive again, to his muscles, his vampiric undead flesh regaining new life. And then they decide to get down to brass tacks, and they go hunting for Mary's organization. So in the previous issue, they've been given some tips and an idea of where Mary will hole up. So they go to this club, which is fronted by Mary's human henchmen, who are kind of like in the Blade movies. The vampires employ humans and make a promise to them that once they fulfill their terms of service, they'll be turned into vampires and given immortality. So there's two of these humans blocking the entrance to this club, and Andrew comes in, and immediately they become hostile. They start shooting at Andrew, but the bullets pass harmlessly through him since he's still a vampire. And then Andrew punches out one of the henchmen with a great sound effect, chock. And then the next one blasts him with a sun gun, which is a weapon that you find here in the iVampire stories. It's a weapon developed by humans, but then appropriated by vampires later on. And basically it blasts a kind of a laser, but they describe it as a highly concentrated burst of light, UV light. But obviously Andrew's immune. The henchman is surprised because he sees that Andrew's a vampire with the fangs sprouting from his mouth, but he's startled that the sun gun doesn't do any damage. Then Andrew grabs him, obviously gets the information he needs out of him, and the police show up and raid the club. So then Andrew and Deborah sort of make a deal with the police, because it seems that Andrew has a contact in the police force saying that they will flush out the murderers that have been plaguing Paris of late, and they will do so tonight. So Andrew, he sort of infiltrates the club. Now, this is a vampire club, so obviously vampires show up here at night. And the funny thing is, Andrew he's not much for wearing a disguise. He wears his full attire, which is still the 14th century nobleman clothes that he's always been wearing in comic books. And this looks really, really funny. I mean, basically it's a massive coat that he wears, this blue coat with this very high collar. And the collar is sort of turned down, but even though it's been folded backward, it's still well above his ears. And then he's wearing this silken red necktie, which he always sports, but it's almost like a scarf. It's like almost like a scarf with this. He's got this white streak of hair with this golden hairband binding his hair into a ponytail at the back. So obviously he stands out in the crowd. So I'm surprised that none of Mary's vampires can recognize him. But he finds one of the vampires, attractive young lass, and he sort of, starts chatting with her. And she says, "Are you here for the show? For the entertainment?" And the entertainment turns out to be a human couple lured into the club on the stage, and the entertainment provided is sort of the hypnotic variety. Some vampires show up on the stage, they throw around their powers of hypnotism, and they separate this couple from each other. First, two vampiric girls perform a hypnotic trance dance, and the boy is lured away from the girl on the stage, and then he's embraced by the two vampiric women, and a male vampire shows up and hypnotizes the girl. And he's just about to rip her throat out when the police raid the place. And this is all staged. This is Andrew's, one of his strategies. A very interesting plan. The police raid. He's obviously a vampire. He says he's new to the city. He needs a place to go. So when the vampires scatter, Andrew scatters with them. And he follows this girl that he met, who's obviously one of Mary's cronies. And she says, come, I know a place where we can hole up, where we'll be safe from the humans, and where you can spend the day. So she's obviously talking about Mary's vampire lair. So then Andrew does find Mary's lair. It's this old this old church, cathedral actually, on the outskirts of Paris. And Andrew then follows the vampire in, and his plan is to sleep in a coffin there. But when all the vampires are asleep, when the sun rises, he will obviously rise from his coffin. The sun doesn't affect him. And then he will stake all of them. Unfortunately, things don't go as planned. And this is how we get very near to the end of the iVampire story, which I will discuss in future episodes. But I don't want to give away any spoilers right now. Suffice it to say that Andrew cannot wake up from the coffin. Even though he thought he was one step ahead of Mary, it seems that she was one step ahead of him this time. His strategies didn't pan out because she purposefully allowed the serum that he took earlier in the comic to fall into his hands. And that serum was not untested. Mary did test it on vampires, and as it turns out, the serum only gives you 24 hours of being a living vampire. Then your body becomes completely inert as you succumb to rigor mortis. Rigor mortis being the muscles in your body atrophying after death. And they become rigid and stiff and unable to be moved. And this is exactly what afflicts Andrew at the end of this tale. So we have Andrew lying in his coffin. The final few panels show this, where he wonders why he can't move, why can't he wake up, and then he feels the sun passing above him. He feels the coming of night. And as the moon rises, Mary and all her vampire army cronies and soldiers and the girl who lured him there, they take off the lid of his coffin, and Mary stands above him, gloating over him. And then the final caption box states, "The stunning saga of Andrew Bennett reaches its shattering conclusion next month. Be here." So that's it for the Andrew Bennett story in House of Mystery number 318. Great story. I would advise you to pick it up if you can. There is a trade paperback out, Eyed Vampire. It is still available on Amazon. You can Andrew Bennett's House of Mystery comics are not available on Comixology, unfortunately, but the back issues are still available from lots of comic book stores. So you can order it through the mail, or if you live near a good comic book store, such as Midtown Comics in New York or any of those places, you'll definitely be able to find these back issues. And I would recommend reading at least House of Mystery number 310 to House of Mystery number 319 if you want to get the full scope of the iVampire story. So, great tale. I would give this story 9 Bloody Marys out of 10. That's how good it was. The art is great. Tom Sutton, his inking is so good that It actually looks like his penciling. So it seems like Tom, who's a famous horror artist, might have sort of subverted Dan Day's pencils here. But Dan Day, also obviously a great penciler, he's been penciling the iVampire comic for a while now. But Tom Sutton, you can really see him coming through strongly in this issue. There's a collected edition out of Tom Sutton's Creepy Things. You can find that on Amazon. It's a very good showcase of his art. And this is him at the height of his powers. Tom Sutton drawing great panels and images in this comic book. The art is very robust. The colors are very, very lush. So yeah, you have to check this out. Then we get to the second story, The Day After Doomsday. The story is by George Kasdan, art by Vos Montalis and Mattuccini, lettered by Bernard Lagman and colored by Nancy Houlihan. All right, this is your typical post-apocalyptic tale. You've got this young couple walking around half-naked Blue Lagoon style, and they're walking in a wasteland of broken machines and technology. So it's literally the day after doomsday. There's been a massive nuclear holocaust, and these two humans have somehow survived. They never mention how they survived, but they're both quite fetching. The man is like this muscular kind of hunk, football player physique, very handsome face. The girl is this model, and it seems like they're the prime, and they're both intelligent. It turns out the man is a computer engineer, and so it seems like they're the perfect specimens to restart the human race, so to speak. But as it turns out, they are very worried about their prospects because there's no food, and there's no other humans who can help them. And as they pass by this giant pile of broken technology, they hear this voice, this robotic voice mumbling, in the vicinity, organic beings, in the vicinity, organic beings. And they just find this head of this robot. And the guy, being a computer engineer, he picks up the head and he starts trying to tinker with it. And he says, hey, if he can scavenge for parts around this this broken factory or junkyard or wherever they are, then he might be able to build or rebuild this robot, and he could program it to help them, to find food for them, to locate other survivors. So at first the girl thinks this is quite a dubious plan, but then later she gets with the program, so to speak, and then she helps him to find the missing limbs and the arms and the circuit box, everything he needs to repair the robot. So the art here is pretty great. I really enjoyed it. The detail is very fine. So Vos Montalis and Mattuccini, they did a really, really good job here on the art. And lots of shadows, but not too many. It's also very brightly colored. And eventually the robot is ready, and they activate it with this activator circuit that they found, just to test it. And the robot immediately starts moving around. It's much taller than a human, but it looks very silly, dressed in this purple armor with this funny little red hat. Kind of looks like a robotic fireman. And the robot starts moving around and walking, and again it starts talking, and it says, in the vicinity, organic beings. And the girl's starting to get creeped out here. The robot's moving towards her, and she says, he doesn't look very friendly. And then the robot says, mission commencing. And he touches the girl and he electrocutes her with millions of volts. So she dies, and the guy is panicking. He runs to deactivate the robot, but the robot turns and grabs him by the throat and strangles him in horrific fashion. And then as the robot moves away from the two dead bodies, it intones, mission complete, organic beings destroyed. And then we see Kane, the host of the House of Mystery, sitting at the bottom of the final panel where it says the end, and he's sitting in front of a sign that says Government Computer Project Warrior Robots Division. So obviously these two managed to rebuild and reactivate robots with the sole mission to kill humans that it encounters. So a very silly little throwaway story, but great art. So I would give this story definitely 6 Bloody Marys out of 10. No question. I think great art, but the story is a little bit lackluster. Interesting, but not one of my favorites. Then in the comic book, we've got Kane's mailroom. Lots of people writing into Kane, asking about earlier issues of I, Vampire and House of Mystery. And one reader references an earlier tale called Eyes of Love, which was, she says, plagiarized, or he says this story plagiarized Robert Bloch's Psycho book. So then the editor gets into a bit of a spat with this this guy who wrote in reference that. And then you've got some people talking about Woodstock and how that's influenced the comic book. Weird, really, really weird. You've got a guy writing in about Houdini, and then you've got Coming Comics. No other horror being available. But Justice League, Wonder Woman, Iraq, Son of Thunder, Black Hawk, DC Comics Presents, Fury of Firestorm, Adventure Comic Book Digest, previews featuring those comics. Then we get to a very interesting little tale, which I read obsessively as a kid, because this was my first disturbing comic book tale which featured almost no supernatural elements. This was completely human on human cruelty and violence and murder. And this is the final tale called Stalk and Slash. It starts off with two lovers in the park. They're kissing. They bid each other farewell. And as the girl walks away, she hears her boyfriend sort of screaming in pain, and she says, "What happened?" And she asks, "Are you okay?" And she walks back into the park, and then she's attacked by this killer with this giant sort of serrated blade. It's almost as long as a short sword, and then we see he's dragging the corpse of her dead boyfriend as he moves towards her, ready to cut her apart. And then we see the title Stalk and Slash written in blood beneath the killer's feet as he runs towards the girl. And now you must wonder, this killer must be pretty strong to drag the boyfriend's body while he's running towards the girl, ready to cut her apart. And he, in fact, obviously does kill her. So you've got Kane grinning up in the top right-hand corner of this page, this splash page that shows the killer killing these two lovers. And then we go to the next page where there's a reporter waking up after he gets a phone call from an informant saying that there's been a murder. In fact, a double homicide. He needs to get down to the police station immediately for the press conference. And this reporter is called Vic. He's a pretty good reporter. He's got a lot of fire and a lot of drive to succeed. He wants to win a Pulitzer Prize. He wants to make his career by publishing a successful story. And he's the first person to get all the facts from the police about this slasher, this killer that's stalking the city. So he's congratulated at work by the publisher himself, Mr. Levinson. And of course, this reporter, Vic Andrews. He thanks the publisher, Mr. Levinson, and he says, "Okay, I'm well on my way to making a splasher and elevating my career." So he visits the morgue to study the victims, and the mortician tells him that these marks of the victim's weapon, whatever he's been using, they're all serrated, and all of the weapons are different. So then for some reason, there's a wild leap in logic here. Vic tells the mortician, "It's like a ritual murder." And then Vic goes to the library and he manages to find library books detailing weapons used for sacrifices. Famous sacrificial weapons used by different cultures for human sacrifice. And he manages to find all the weapons that have been used in the previous murders as well, simply by looking at the pictures and deducing that this weapon will make this type of wound, which is similar to the wound on one of the previous bodies. And I don't know how he did that, but it's a comic book, so let's suspend our disbelief there for a moment. All right, so we've got Vic doing his super sleuthing in the library, and then he shows up at his at the publisher, at the newspaper, asking them to print this story. But then he changes his mind and says, okay, well, hold up. If there's another kill, this will prove my point, because I've predicted that the next weapon to be used will be this axe, which he found in the book, which is sort of the next weapon listed after the serrated blade that the murderer previously used. And in fact, Vic's theory is proven true, because a university professor walks home to his apartment, and as he enters and walks up the staircase, he's attacked by the slasher with the same sacrificial axe that we saw portrayed in Vic's book. So the professor's dead, Vic publishes the story, and everybody loves it. They say Vic predicted this correctly. He's the best reporter in the city. But this creates a panic among the people in Boston, where this story is set. And then Vic goes further into his research, and he determines that the reason why the killer is committing ritual murder is because he believes that these victims are sacrifices, and these sacrifices will lead to his eternal to eternal life being given to him by the gods that he's sacrificing these victims to. And in fact, he's found this from the books too. The books tell him that if you murder people with these weapons in this order, the gods will grant you favor and make you immortal. But then weeks pass and nothing happens. No subsequent murders occur. And then people start teasing him. Fellow reporters start berating Vic, saying that his wild theory didn't pan out. Nothing's happening. The police can't use his information to catch the killer. The killer's finished. Vic's story probably scared him off. They were getting too close. Now he's lying low, gone into hiding. It'll probably be years before he kills again. And for some reason, this sort of Vic's career takes a bad turn just because of this. And everybody's against him. Even the publisher turns against him, and they say that, okay, Vic, you should take a week off or so. And then finally he gets fired. So he was literally fired because his story didn't pan out. But obviously the killer, if the police doesn't catch the killer, it's not the reporter's fault. So for some reason they fired him. Vic then becomes desperate. So desperate, because his career is in ruins, that he figures that if the killer kills again, his career will be saved. And while he's thinking these thoughts, saying that if there was another murder, they'd believe me, he goes to a hardware store and he buys, or it could have been a hunting store. Yeah, sorry, it's a hunting goods store. And he buys an axe, and he waylays a woman in an alley and kills her, chops her apart with his axe. And then the next day, he's congratulated by everybody in his local pub. All the reporters hang out there, and they say, Vic, sorry, we were wrong to doubt you. Your story panned out. The killer's back. And then he gets a phone call from the publisher himself, Mr. Levinson. And Mr. Levinson invites him up to his penthouse for a drink and says, Vic, your story panned out. You're the man. Really, your predictive skills are awesome. And just to show my appreciation for your talents, have a drink with me. For the record, says Mr. Levinson, I always believed your stories. And then he hits Vic with this next line. He says, even though I know you committed the last murder, Vic. And then Vic is surprised. Well, he's surprised that the old man knows what he's talking about. And Mr. Levinson then goes towards a display case covered by a curtain, and he moves aside the curtain, and you see all these sacrificial weapons hanging on this display. It's sort of like a display rack, actually, against the wall. Dozens of sacrificial weapons, the serrated blade he used to kill the girl, the axe he used to kill the university professor, and a final weapon which is hung in the middle of all these weapons. So this is the final weapon he needs to use. And then he takes it down from the display case and he walks towards Vic, stalking him relentlessly. Vic backs up. And then Mr. Levinson explains to him, he says, Vic, you guessed every detail, the ritual, the eternal life, that the victims were chosen carefully, but you caught on too late. The sacrifices were all over, save for a last sacrifice, which required the killing of a very special man, a man who would commit murder himself for greed to further his own ambition. You are that man, Vic. And then we see Mr. Levinson about to plunge this sacrificial knife into Vic's heart. And he says, relax, Vic, you'll go quicker than the others. Just one incision to remove the heart of a murderer. And this presumably will give Mr. Levinson eternal life. And we see this background image behind Levinson as he walks towards Vic, but also towards the reader. We are actually now seeing Mr. Levinson through Vic's eyes. He's stalking us, coming out of the page, and behind him we see this image of these acolytes praying to this demonic god with this sacrificial victim lying on an altar. And that's how the story ends. So very creepy tale, this last one, Stalk and Slash. The title of the story doesn't even do it justice. It just sounds like a normal slasher tale, but actually it's got this deep undercurrent of superstition and ritual murder and this religious fervor. So great story. I also give this story 9 Bloody Marys out of 10, similar to the Andrew Bennett tale. Well, that's it for our first segment. We'll be back after a quick promo from a friend of mine.
When you talk about comics, does it sound something like this?
Look, you can't put the Superman number 77s with the 200s. They haven't even discovered red kryptonite yet. And you can't put the number 98 with the 300s. Lori Lamaris hasn't even been introduced.
Or maybe it sounds a little more like this.
You think Mighty Mouse could beat up Superman?
What are you, cracked?
Why not? I saw the other day he was carrying 5 elephants in one hand.
Boy, you don't know nothing. Mighty Mouse is a cartoon. Superman is a real guy. No way a cartoon could beat up a real guy.
Yeah, maybe you're right. It would be a good fight, though.
Hello, I am the constantly caffeinated Clinton Robinson, and my comics discussions can go to both extremes, but generally fall somewhere in between. On the Coffee and Comics podcast, I will review comic stories and other comics-related topics that can be enjoyed over a cup of coffee. So pour the coffee, or other beverage of choice, and join me on the Coffee and Comics podcast, available on iTunes and coffeeandcomicspodcast.blogspot.com.
Next up is our Erin segment. That's right, folks, she's back.
You keep saying you got something for me. Something you call love, but confess. You've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
We've got some questions from listeners here that need to be answered. And our semi-co-host, Erin, kindly volunteered to help with that. So, hi, Erin. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah. Let's get this over with so I can go back to my Netflix queue.
Wow. Thanks for the uplifting response. It does wonders for my self-confidence, Erin. So, we got emails to get through. Let's get cracking.
The first is from Darren. He says, hey, Herman, I'm really digging the show. I've noticed that you skip a week here and there, and that the show doesn't quite come out on a weekly basis. What's up with that?
Okay, good question there, Darren. Well, yeah, I remember I once said somewhere on a show that it would come out every Monday night. I'm really trying to make that schedule work, but as of now, it seems that the show comes out bi-monthly. So every other week, you can expect it around Monday night or Tuesday, give or take, depends where you live in the world. But I'll really try to make it more regularly. Sometimes I'll even throw in some bonus shows or some specials. We'll see how it goes. So I apologize for that, Darren. But hey, man, keep listening. Thanks for the response. So what about the next one, Erin?
Next is a question from a guy called Alan. He says, love the show, man. Maybe you can help me out. My 11-year-old niece is starting to watch horror films and I want to get her something special for her birthday. Are there any titles you would recommend? Keep up with the good work.
Wow. Good question. Thanks, Arlen, for writing it. All right. I assume, yeah, you obviously mean comic books here, even though she's into horror films. I hope she will like reading comics. It's actually much different from watching films. But yeah, I gladly answer this question because I've been thinking about it a lot lately since my little daughter hopefully will one day grow up to be a horror fan. I'm already cataloging some titles in my mind that I want to let her read one day. I think the best one out there at the moment is probably Eric Powell. Eric Powell's Spook House. It's a comic book published by Albatross Funny Books, which is Eric Powell's comic book imprint. So yeah, try out Spook House. It's available digitally on Comixology as well, if she likes to read on an iPad or something. Or you can just buy her the single issues. They don't have a trade out yet, I think. So you could let her read that. Yeah, that's about the only one I'd feel confident recommending. You might also want to give her Beasts of Burden from Dark Horse. That's done by Jill Thompson and Evan Dorkin. Jill Thompson on art. Beasts of Burden. That's quite an all-ages kind of horror comic, if such a thing exists. Hope that answers your question, Arlen. What's the next one, Erin?
Nikki writes in with some suggestions. She says, I enjoy listening to the show and reading the blog. On the recent post about Dracula in comics, I was surprised that you did not include Dracula, a company of monsters, and the cameo of Jack from Jig Rock's aphrodisiac comic. This last one made me laugh.
All right. Nikki, thanks for those suggestions. Oh, that's referring to the blog I wrote, with a blog post I recently uploaded about Dracula, comic book incarnations of Dracula. All right, so I've actually never read Dracula, A Company of Monsters. So once I do, I'll probably update the post if I really like it, if I think it warrants a mention, Nikki. But you obviously like it, so I'm taking your word for it. I'm definitely going to read it now. I love to read anything Dracula-related. And then as to your final mention of Dracula in Jim Rugg's Aphrodisiac comic, I did read Aphrodisiac, and I did not like that portrayal of Dracula because, like you say, it's laughable, it's funny, it's comedic. That's not my kind of Dracula. You know, I take Dracula very seriously. Like, if you think about what Dracula told Jonathan Harker when Harker made light of his ancestry, the Dracul family in the movie, and Dracula flew off the handle and said, "It is no laughing matter." Well, that's how I feel about Dracula in comic book forms. He shouldn't be included in a funny book where his brains get punched out by a 70s pimp. But, you know, I love Jim Rugg's Aphrodisiac, so I'm not taking down the comic here, but I just did not enjoy that portrayal of Dracula at all. So sorry about that, Nikki, but thanks for the suggestions. Write in with some more, why don't you? All right, what's the last one, Erin?
The last one is from Lord Svetinari.
Mm-hmm.
He asked, who is Erin? Are you guys married?
Well, okay, personal question. So I'm going to let Erin answer that. Erin?
Duh. I hope we are not.
So we aren't married? Or we are?
I don't know.
Well, I will leave it with that vague response there, that arbitrary response of Aaron there. So, Aaron, thanks again. I really appreciate you helping me out with the admin of the show. So hopefully you'll be back again next week. Take care of yourself. Until next time.
Yeah, I can't wait.
All right, everybody, that's our Aaron segment for the week. When we come back, we'll look at our history of horror comic book section.
And you keep losing when you ought to not bet. You keep saying when you ought to be a changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for...
Welcome to Herman's History of Horror. Listen freely and of your own will.
All right, in our last segment, we left off talking about EC Comics' Tales from the Crypt from the early 50s, and also we moved on to the Vault of Horror. Now, today we'll be looking more at the Vault of Horror. It's also a very important comic in the history of the medium. And like Tales from the Crypt, the Vault of Horror was not above ripping off stories from other sources. Island of Terror was borrowed from the short story The Most Dangerous Game, and Baby It's Cold Inside in Vault of Horror number 17 was an adaptation of a Lovecraft tale, Cool Air. Voodoo Horror was a rewrite of The Picture of Dorian Gray. Then we also have The Thing in the Ice. It's a kind of a sequel to Frankenstein. Dead Weight, where a man steals pearls from a native woman, is taken from John Russell's story, short story, The Price of the Head. So lots of stories that they almost plagiarized in the Vault of Horror. But they also had a lot of original content. And most of the art was, again, by the stalwart crew of EC artists, Jack Davis being at the forefront here. And you've got great tales such as Terror on the Moors, Dying to Lose Weight, About Face, People Who Live in Brass Hearses, Strictly from Hunger, Practical Choke. All of these tales are completely original and standout tales. They've got great art. And most of them feature criminals, obviously, who get their supernatural comeuppance in some form or other, either at the hands of their dead victims or through a bad turn of fate. You've got some disturbing stories as well that obviously made it into the sort of Inquisition that happened a little bit later, around 1956 and 57 or so, when they vilified the horror comics. Stories like Shoe Button Eyes. It's a story of child abuse. An alcoholic who winds up with very strange eyes after he abuses this child. And then you also have a story called O. Henry, which is sort of like the writer O. Henry, except in this case it's obviously written as O-H-O. And then comma Henry. And it's a story about a cop who put an old woman in jail for 60 days for shoplifting, and he refused to check up on her story about her invalid husband at home, alone with no food, until he finds out that he should have listened to her. In fact, there was an invalid husband at home, and he died and lay there decaying, moldering in the apartment without the old woman being able to take care of him. So you've got all these interesting stories. And then this leads into EC's publishing of a title called Crime Suspense Stories. Now this was focused more on obviously criminals and serial killers, almost no supernatural events. And they had some great, great stories as well. This is more psychological horror, similar to stories like Psycho, and a lot of Richard Matheson's short stories, Robert Blow being obviously the author of Psycho. But you had some rare Ray Bradbury stories cropping up in crime suspense stories too, stories like The Jar. Remember, at this time, Bradbury had given them permission to adapt some of his stories. There's a memorable story in Crime Suspense Stories that you can find in one of the new collected editions. It's Crime Suspense Stories number 12. I think it's in... yeah, it hasn't been collected yet. It's called The Execution, where a man sits on death row. No one will believe that he was helping a man whose car was stuck in a snowdrift at the same time that a woman, his victim, was being murdered. So this man has never come forth, and the condemned man has lost all hope. He's going to be executed, and the story goes through the step-by-step process of his final day on earth as he walks the final mile, and then he's killed in the electric chair. And it turns out that the man who pulled the switch, who'd been on vacation and knew nothing about the case, he was the man that this executed criminal had helped in the blizzard. And actually, if you look at the story very carefully, it sort of falls apart. The plot doesn't really work, but the art sort of carries it through. So you've got lots of these stories. They sort of were rushed, but they're still very memorable simply because of the art. Because the art was, even though the art might have been rushed too, the artists still did high quality jobs simply because of the caliber of their talent. And then we also have a very interesting Ray Bradbury story, very notable, called The Screaming Woman. It's in Crime Suspense Stories number 15. A little girl hears a woman screaming for help under the ground, and then she tells numerous people, including her parents, about the screaming woman, but nobody will believe her. And the suspense keeps building and building, and this little girl has to endure a long supper with her family, still hearing this woman screaming in her ears, but the family doesn't hear anything. Then she goes out to the lot and she begins digging for the woman all on her own. Eventually she enlists the aid of this little boy who thinks that she's a ventriloquist, because he in turn also hears this woman screaming. Okay, I shouldn't laugh. This is pretty morbid. So you've got all these weird, and it turns out this woman was buried alive. These great stories, but it's so weird. And nowadays, I doubt if they will hold up. But obviously, when you buy them in collected form, they're still period pieces, remarkably readable and engaging. So after Crime Suspense Stories, EC had another horror title called The Haunt of Fear. And now we're getting pretty close to the Seduction of the Innocent era, where the psychologist Frederick Wortham is going to lead this witch hunt against comic book publishers. So it's almost... But if you think about it, the stories were progressively getting... pushing the envelope and going further and further. So this was sort of the natural blowback that they could have expected from society in general. I mean, how far can you really go before somebody has to curb whatever you've been doing? But it has since been proven that horror stories, in fact, do not lead to juvenile delinquency, of course. In fact, the opposite is true. Horror stories sort of provide a cathartic element and introduces that into the mix so that people could actually deal with the horrors of real life through experiencing horror fiction or horror comics. So we'll get into that next week, when you start talking about the psychological aspects to horror and horror comics and the faulty arguments presented by Frederick Wortham when he tried to pick apart the horror stories and the horror comics of that time. All right, we're going to take another small break, and when we come back, we'll do our horror character bios. And today we'll be looking at Kane. That's right, the host we talked about earlier, the House of Mystery host, the keeper, in fact, of the House of Mystery.
Back when I was doing Swamp Thing, which was ostensibly a horror comic, I found that it wasn't really effective to just sort of swamp the readers in horror every issue. You needed to do other things that would alleviate the repetitive qualities of the horror and to make it more than a one-note strip. I decided that what might be useful was to try and link up the elements of fantasy horror from our imaginations, werewolves, vampires, zombies and the like, with real life horrors. Racism, sexism, pollution, the collapse of the environment, and thus lend these social issues some of the weight that fantasy fiction could offer. Most of us have little to fear from vampires, and yet we live in cultures that are every bit as dangerous, despite the non-existence of terrible supernatural forces.
Cain, the keeper of the House of Mystery, has his own personal bio and a page in the DC comic book called Who's Who in the DC Universe, which was published way back in 1984 to 1989. So I'm going to just read a bit from that introduction. Okay, there's a great image of Cain sitting on a corpulent dragon, and he's sitting in front of the House of Mystery. The House of Mystery is sort of in what you call a background image, a surprint behind Cain, and it's in pink and white colors, but Cain himself is dressed in his safari suit with his tufts of hair pointing upwards like two devil horns. And he's got a book in his hands, obviously the book that he reads from when he tells tales, when visitors come to the House of Mystery to discover its secrets. And then you've got three sections here. You've got his personal data, his history, and his powers and weapons. I'm sure he has none of, well, kind of has a power. He's sort of immortal. Anyway, so full name, they say unknown. Occupation, caretaker. Marital status, single. Known relatives, Abel, brother. Eve, cousin. Whoa, that's crazy. I thought Eve was his mother. Anyway, my biblical knowledge is not that great. All right, so then we get to his base of operations, the House of Mystery, somewhere in the Kentucky Hills. Interesting. Group affiliation, none. First appearance, House of Mystery number 175. Height 6'2", weight 174 pounds, eyes brown, hair brown. They say here, little is known of the early life of the man called Cain before he became caretaker of the so-called House of Mystery. And thus, it has been speculated that he and his brother Abel, caretaker of the House of Secrets, are in fact the reincarnated manifestations of the biblical Cain and Abel, the first murderer and his victim. What is known is that Cain is a consummate storyteller who takes particular delight in tales designed to terrify his audience. Unlike the House of Secrets, which stands directly across the cemetery from it, nothing is known of the origins of the House of Mystery. It is a large, old, rambling house of indeterminate architecture that has, on occasion, seemed to possess a life of its own. Rooms come and go in the House of Mystery, and no room ever appears to be quite the same any two times one looks at it. And then we get to Cain's powers and weapons. They say here, Cain possesses no true powers, save for a slight malicious streak, a diabolical sense of humor, and an unnatural gift for storytelling. A subpar hand-to-hand combatant, Cain prefers to rely on his wits when confronted with physical violence. And I almost forgot to mention, the art here is by the great Joe Orlando. All right, so Cain, that's him, DC comic book host of the House of Mystery. So I want to mention something here about Cain. For any of you who've read Alan Moore's Saga of the Swamp Thing, there is an issue where Cain kills his brother Abel in an argument while Abby Cable, Swamp Thing's paramour, is having a dream. which turns into a nightmare. She visits the House of Secrets to uncover the secret of how the Swamp Thing became the Swamp Thing. And then Abel shows her around. She likes Abel more than she does his brother Cain. Cain becomes jealous, just like he did in the Bible. Jealousy causes him to then attack Abel, and he beats him to death with a stone. And I still remember that incredible image of it's terrifying, especially when I read this as a kid, around about 1986 or so. Cain jumps on Abel, knocks him down. They wrestle. He straddles Abel, and then he grabs a stone and he smashes the stone into his brother's face. Now Abel is this chubby little guy, very kind of cute, and Cain continues to beat him until he dies. And the sound effect that Alan Moore used when Cain is beating him, every time the rock hits his face, is like wrench, 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 and I just can't get that sound effect out of my head now. That is a terrible sound effect when you're, you know, beating someone with a stone. So he kills him, and it turns out that he does this nightly, on a nightly basis. They're doomed to repeat the very first murder. And there's this great line where Abby Cable tells Cain, you murdered him. And then Cain turns to Abby and says, murder? Don't talk to me about murder. I invented murder. And that scene has always stuck with me. Probably the best moment Cain ever had on the comic book page. So that's it for our horror comic bios. Cain, the horror host of the House of Mystery. All right, next up is our recommendations. And what I'm going to be recommending for you today are basically the comics that I've recently read and bought on the various Halloween sales available online. I've bought lots of physical comics too, but none of them were because of any sales. I couldn't get any discounts on the physical trades and collected editions, but there are quite a few available online. On Comixology, they've got some great deals, and here are just a few of the ones that I recently purchased. Okay, I'm here on my Comixology app. I'm on my smart lists. All right, I purchased Zombie World, Champion of the Worms, which is by Mike Mignola. That's from the Dark Horse. And that was on the Dark Horse Horror Sale. I think I got it for $2.99. I've since finished it. It's great. The art is super good. It's sort of comedic horror, but I would recommend it. Then I purchased some Split Lip Publishing horror comics. I think I purchased six of them. They're all written by a guy called Costello. Let me see here. His name is Sam Costello, with art by a variety of guys and girls. So I can recommend these collections. They're all black and white, but they're very disturbing. There are a few of them. Not Sleeping Well and Other Things That Go Bump in the Night, Last Caress and Other Uncanny Encounters, many more. And then I purchased Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez's Tales from the Dark Side. Of course, Joe and Gabriel are famous for their Lock and Key horror comic. Joe Hill's also famous for being Stephen King's son. Of course, you know, any horror guy or girl worth their salt knows that. So I would recommend those collections. I've read all of them, and all of them are at least 7-star books or more. Or in this case, I should say 7 Bloody Mary, Bloody Marys or more. So that's it for recommendations. Check out those sales. There's probably going to be more sales coming. I know that a Vertigo sale started today. So there's lots of comics out there that you can get for Halloween, for horror. I'll be doing a special Halloween-themed show at the end of the month, but we've got another show coming before then. So hopefully you'll be back, listeners, to listen to me rant and rave about my favorite genre in comics, horror. But I'll be back, like I say again, hopefully next week. So tune in and join me once more for yet another peek into the long box of darkness.